Just walking in the rain.
Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Could five prisoners be allowed to travel to a recording studio and cut tracks for a single today? It's highly unlikely, but that's exactly what happened in June 1953. The Prisoners were escorted from Nashville to Memphis to record Just Walkin' in the Rain, which became a big hit for them and an even bigger hit for Johnny Ray when he covered it. John Dugan, a professor of music business and popular music studies in MTSU's Department of Recording Industry, chronicles the inmate story in his new book, The Mistakes of Yesterday, The Hopes of Tomorrow, The Story of the Prisoners. Crime and punishment, art and commerce, white and black, all collide between the pages, and Dugan will explain it all after some uncommuted sentences from MTSU News.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU students returning to campus in the new year will notice an extra security presence in high traffic areas. In late November, the university hired two uniformed security guards from Allegiant Security Group, a move aimed at providing a consistent, visible presence on campus. A $100,000 donation by retired MTSU photography professor and Murfreesboro resident Harold L. Baldwin will support plans to develop a new photography gallery in the Bragg Mass Communication Building. The renovated space will become the new permanent home of MTSU's photography archive. And MTSU's video of good tidings for the 2012 holiday season is included on a list of the 14 best digital season's greetings produced by the nation's colleges and universities. For MTSU News at any time, go to MTSUnews.com. That's MTSUnews.com.
Oh, John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Before we talk about how the Prisoners blended their vocals, let's talk about how each one of these guys landed in the pokey in the first place.
It was a variety of offenses that meant that some of them were short-timers, some of them were, nominally speaking, going to be in prison for life. Johnny Bragg, their lead singer and probably the founder of the band or the focal point, principal focal point of the band, had been convicted on 6 counts of rape, which is reasonable to assume were trumped-up charges that were used to incarcerate him. So they were in for a variety of offenses, some assault, some manslaughter, some rape. And again, they were because they were in for a variety of offenses, it was never clear how they were going to maintain their group status post-parole. Because they were going to be released at different times. The Prisoner story, because they recorded in 1953, they just predate what most popular music historians consider to be the birth of rock and roll. It's not that it wasn't called rock and roll. It's just that we associate the emergence of rock and roll with the emergence of Elvis Presley in the fall of 1954. So the Prisoners are still recording during an era which is the kind of proto or pre-rock and roll era where
It was called race music.
Race music, rhythm and blues. It was called race music in Billboard magazine up until the late 1940s. And then the term race music had become antiquated, so it was replaced by a Billboard writer by the name of Jerry Wexler, who would go on to be a successful producer with Aretha Franklin in the 60s and many other artists. Changed it to rhythm and blues. So, you know, rock and roll doesn't really come out of nowhere. It emerges from that tradition of rhythm and blues in the late 40s and early 1950s. And the Prisoners are kind of on that cusp of the end of the R&B era and the emergence of the rock and roll era.
Well, how did they come to sing together in the prison? How did they come to realize that they could blend harmonies well?
Well, it was really just luck and happenstance. When Johnny Bragg was incarcerated in 1943, he, as a child, sang on the streets of North Nashville. And when he was incarcerated, he realized that there were a number of groups of inmates who were singing primarily gospel music. And Johnny had grown up singing gospel music as a child, and he was very fond of it. So he found himself in with a group of inmates who enjoyed singing, but they had fluctuating membership in any of these groups. And it wasn't really until Johnny joined and they started singing together, that they crafted their sound, and the other prisoners joined up. They started forming a sound that was kind of unique to their circumstances. And I think at the time, they didn't imagine doing anything other than singing in prison talent shows. I mean, certainly they weren't thinking about making a record or touring, which they effectively did for a couple of years. I think they saw themselves as primarily just this was something they would do to help offset the kind of brutal reality of being incarcerated.
Frank Clement was governor of Tennessee around this time, wasn't he?
Yes. Frank Clement was elected governor in 1952. He became the youngest governor in the state, not just the state of Tennessee, but the youngest governor in the United States.
And I think this probably turned out to be fortunate for the prisoners because, unlike some of his Southern contemporaries, he did not share these harsh perspectives on either segregation or incarceration. He used to go down to death row and visit the death row inmates at the pen.
Yes, he was. I wasn't able to interview Frank Clement, who passed away, died in 1969, but I was able to go through a lot of his personal papers and read a lot of biographical material on Governor Clement. And yes, he was a staunch opponent of the death penalty. And found that to be the most distasteful part of his job as governor. As for the prisoners and Frank Clement's intercession in their popularity, that was predicated on the fact that he wanted to overhaul the prison system, something that I don't think he successfully did in his time as governor.
But he saw this as sort of a pilot project for rehabilitation or something?
Yes. Yeah, this was very much built on this model of prison management that goes back to the early 19th century called the Auburn model, which is predicated on the notion that prisons could in effect become self-sufficient, that it would lower tax rates for citizens to support prisons. It would lower rates of recidivism if inmates were taught the love of work and the habit of work and actually were trained for, in the 19th century, a newly industrialized economy. So when James Edwards became warden of the Tennessee State Penitentiary, he saw this permutation, this variation on the Auburn model as a way to promote the fact that things were changing in the prison and that despite the fact that these men had made mistakes in their lives that led to their incarceration, that they could in fact turn their lives around and be creative and productive members of society.
We'll have more about the prisoners in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Tennessee's farm families contribute to our state's economy, nutrition, and culture. The Tennessee Century Farms program at MTSU's Center for Historic Preservation acknowledges farms that have been in the same family for at least 100 years. To date, the program has certified more than 1,000 farms. This is Kenita Hankins, director of the Tennessee Century Farms program.
And for all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
John Dugan, professor in the Department of Recording Industry, is our guest. He's the author of The Mistakes of Yesterday, The Hopes of Tomorrow, The Story of the Prisoners, five African-American men who had a hit record despite being inmates at the Tennessee State Penitentiary in the 1950s. And this is the old penitentiary, right? This is the stone building that looks like a medieval dungeon.
Yes, it's the Gothic fortress out in Cockrell Bend in West Nashville.
Yeah.
It's still there, and it was decommissioned as a prison and shut down in the early 1990s. But it's been used by Hollywood a number of times to stage prison movies.
How did the prisoners come to the attention of the recording community?
Somewhat circuitously, there was a reporter by the name of Joe Calloway who came to the prison. He was doing a story on prison reform. And while he was there, he happened to hear the prisoners sing. And he thought it would be a good idea to bring them out to a local radio station, WSOK, and perform. And again, Warden James Edwards thought this would be a good opportunity for the prisoners to be out kind of stumping for representing the reforms that were going on at the prison. So they ended up at radio station WSOK, and they sang, I think, four songs that day live on the air one of which was Just Walkin' in the Rain, which would become their big hit. And then the ball started rolling from there. There were a number of people in the industry who liked the marketing potential of a group of inmates kind of, quote-unquote, singing their way out of prison.
Kind of a novelty approach.
Yes, a novelty approach. That you know, I mean, the music industry, you have to understand the nature of the music industry in the early to mid-1950s. This is a world of kind of fast buck entrepreneurs flying by the seat of their pants, they're, you know, making up the rules as they go along. You know, there's no aspect of marketing that they would leave unnoticed or unused. So the idea that you would have a group of convicts who were singing would be a great way to shift records. But beyond that, Ward and Edwards saw them as linked to the prison reform strategies that he and Edwards were moving forward. And whenever they could, brought them out to sing in public to show them off to movers and shakers in Nashville who wanted to know what was going on behind this new progressive pinology that was being enacted at the prison.
So in this entrepreneurial whiz-bang whatever-works environment in the recording industry, It wasn't hard to find somebody who would take a risk, if you will, on a prison singing group.
Right, and they were lucky enough to become involved with the person most likely to help them out, and that would be Sam Phillips at Sun Records.
Now, it figures that Sam would, because At Sun Records, anybody could go in off the street. If you wanted to sing Happy Birthday to You for your mama, you could come into Sun Records, and for whatever they charged you,
it was like $4 to go in. You could cut an acetate there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing about Sun Records that people tend to not understand completely is that Sun Records was actually the record label. I mean, we refer to the whole enterprise, the kind of mini empire that Phillips built in Memphis, as Sun Records. But the reality was is that the recording studio was called the Memphis Recording Service. Mm-hmm. And I think their motto was something to the effect of, we record anything, anytime, anywhere. And that's where, you know, Elvis Presley famously wandered in off the street and cut an acetate of the song My Happiness, which he gave to his mother as a birthday present in 1954, and then later went on there to record more officially for Sam Phillips. But
and Sam didn't have any problem having black clientele either.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, Phillips was a very progressive Southerner in that regard, that he had no segregationist impulses and no outward racial animus. The other thing that led him to record the Prisoners was the fact that he was a big supporter of Frank Clement. He thought Frank Clement was the best governor that Tennessee had ever had, and he wanted to do right by him. And if it meant recording the Prisoners, he would help in any way. The Prisoners recorded in a vocal style that seems kind of odd when you think of some of the other acts that Phillips recorded in the early 50s at Sun Records, people like Rufus Thomas and Howlin' Wolf. You know, he did love kind of rougher-edged, bluesy singers. But
right down to the guts of it.
Yeah, right down to the guts of it. I mean, he famously said of Howlin' Wolf's voice, "This is where the soul of man never dies." It wasn't as if he saw the Prisoners in strictly a kind of a crass marketing kind of way. I think he did really like them as vocalists and did really like their overall sound.
Because this was the kind of music that when it was re-recorded by white folks, this was the down to the roots of it kind of music. And then white folks who loved it, some of them took it and quote-unquote whited it up, cleaned it up, made it, you know, slicker so that it wouldn't frighten off certain white audiences who still had some discriminatory ideas about black people.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, you could make that argument that this is exactly the case with the song Just Walking in the Rain when Johnny Ray got a hold of it in 1956, that if one listens to the Prisoners version, it speaks more to that kind of smooth, early doo-wop R&B vocalizing, close harmony singing. And when you hear Johnny Ray's version, it's, you know, it's more about him as the lead vocalist, but the arrangement is really cluttered. It's, it, you know, it's, it, all of those beautiful kind of plangent R&B sentiments that you hear in the Prisoners version are missing from Johnny Ray's version, because it's just cluttered. It's a mess.
And Johnny Ray had that overwrought, overly emotional voice. I mean, right. Roy Orbison could evoke emotion too, but he didn't. He didn't ham it up. Like, you know, Johnny Ray is like a soap opera emotional voice, right. And Roy Orbison is like a straight, credible drama, dramatic, emotional
voice.
Yeah,
I think had Roy Orbison recorded it, he might have done a nice cover of it. Johnny Ray, now I know there are people listening to this who are probably huge fans of Johnny Ray who think that I'm performing some kind of horrific revisionist historical disservice by treating Johnny Ray in such a disreputable manner. But, Johnny Ray was arguably the most important pop pre-rock and roll vocalist in American popular music in the early to mid-1950s. It's just that his version of Just Walking in the Rain, it's kind of an assault. He kind of bludgeons the song. There's nothing about it that gets to the kind of beautiful emotional undercurrent of the song. It's all just kind of...
You don't envision somebody ambling through the park while walking in the rain when Johnny sings it.
Yeah, no, when the Prisoners sing it, and with Johnny's lead vocal, it's a very sorrowful, very emotional song, and Johnny Ray makes it seem as though it's kind of happy, but the song is about, you know, disassociation, love lost, about feeling bad. It's not a particularly happy song. So Ray Conniff, who arranged the session for Johnny Ray, and Mitch Miller, who produced it, took a really bizarre kind of aesthetic strategy to doing the song, and it seems counterintuitive to what the song is actually about.
When you said Mitch Miller produced it, that sort of said it all for me.
Yeah,
I have this vision in my head. More about the Prisoners in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Concrete Industry Management Program at MTSU fills the need for trained personnel who know concrete technology and techniques. Our alumni go into the marketplace grounded in basic math and science and able to promote products or services related to the industry. Our participation in the Academic Common Market ensures talented students in other states a chance to enroll on an in-state tuition basis. This is Dr. Heather Brown, Director of the program.
To find out more information on this or other university programs, visit mtsunews.com.
We're talking with John Dugan, author of The Mistakes of Yesterday, The Hopes of Tomorrow, The Story of the Prisoners. He's also a professor of recording industry here at MTSU. So the Prisoners make it down the highway from the Nashville, from the State Pen to Sun Records,
yes,
where they record Just Walking in the Rain for Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And did the DJs that played race music at WLAC at that time, John R., Hoss Allen, Hugh Baby Jarrett, Gene Nobles, that bunch, did they end up playing Just Walking in the Rain by the Prisoners once it became a hit, or
yeah,
before it became a hit? Did they help to make it a hit?
I think they helped make it a hit, and I'm sure Hoss Allen was on this track, and Nobles were on this track at some point, because, you know, the local angle really spoke to them. So I think that they were, I don't want to go so far as to say that they were instrumental in the song becoming a hit. I think the song was becoming a hit on black radio stations across the Southeast. I think it was getting a lot of airplay in Memphis. It was getting a lot of airplay in places like Jackson, Mississippi. And it was getting national notoriety in the trade magazines. Billboard had picked up on it. Cashbox had picked up on it, but also, you know, they were getting a run in the local newspapers, the Banner, the Tennessean, the Press Scimitar, the Commercial Appeal in Memphis. The African American magazine of record, Ebony, had picked up on this story because it was such a compelling story, and why not cover it? And I think that the more it got radio play, the more it sold in the Southeast. Now, we have to keep in mind that Just Walking in the Rain, the Prisoners version, was really a regional hit. When Johnny Ray covered it in 1956, he made it a kind of national hit. But with the Prisoners, it was more a regional thing. And I've spoken to friends of mine who live in different parts of the country who knew the song when they were young, and their familiarity with the song was linked to Johnny Ray and not the Prisoners. WLAC's decision to move into R&B programming was really a late 40s, early 1950s phenomenon. So it you know, the Prisoners releasing Just Walking in the Rain in 1953 comes along right at a good time for a radio station like WLAC to pick up on it. That and the notion that, you know, one of the things that I think people forget about Nashville's musical history was there was a pretty strong rhythm and blues scene here in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. Was there any blowback against the Tennessee Department of Corrections for letting this happen?
Well, there was a certain amount of blowback, but I think it was primarily from the Tennessean. And luckily for, and I think there were other people that worked at prisons. In the book, I quote Wilfred Denno, who was the warden at the notorious Sing Sing prison in upstate New York. And, you know, he, once he got wind of this story, he made it abundantly clear that this would never happen in a facility such as his. And it creates a hierarchy that favors some prisoners over the other. And his argument was is that the prisoners it favors are put at greater risk inside the institution because there's a sense of jealousy of the other inmates, that they have this, you know, nice life, et cetera. And I think there was just a reluctance to see, especially African American, I think there's a racial element involved too, with the notion that African Americans who've been convicted of a crime are being let loose to work their trade, as it were, in public. And they did receive money as a result of their performances, but a lot of that was funneled into an inmate fund. They were able to keep a very small percentage of what they made as the Prisoners.
So it's not like they were getting rich off the royalties.
No. Johnny did reasonably well because he and Robert Riley, who was co-wrote the song with him but was not an actual performing member of the Prisoners, between Riley and Robert Riley and Johnny, they did receive royalties on the publishing rights to the song as a result of the exploitation of the copyright. So by the time Johnny was paroled in the late 50s, he would return to prison a number of times after that. He had some money in the bank. Sam Phillips tried his best to catch lightning in a bottle a second time, but he simply couldn't do it. Either the songs weren't there, or he somewhat inexplicably, their follow-up single to Just Walking in the Rain was a cover of the old gospel chestnut Softly and Tenderly. And I think if he stayed with more secular R&B, he might have been able to further their career. But I was able to get an interview with Sam Phillips where he expressed a certain amount of regret that he wasn't able to do more with their career, because they simply couldn't capitalize on Just Walking in the Rain. They never had that follow-up single that would continue the success that they had built up and the goodwill they had built up. And the fact that they were being paroled at different times wasn't helping matters either.
What happened to them after the glow of celebrity wore off? You said one of them kept returning to prison.
Johnny, yeah. Johnny was
did.
Paroled. His sentence was commuted by Frank Clement, and he was paroled. But he was brought back two or three times on parole violations. And despite the fact that he was initially incarcerated in 1943, he didn't walk out of the prison for the last time until, I believe it was 1977, was the last time he walked out of prison and did not return. While he was in, even though he violated his parole and was returned to prison, he continued with a group called the Prisoners, but then their membership started to fluctuate and change. And then at one point he dismissed the name Prisoners altogether and started a prison group called the Marigolds. They were a little more kind of R&B oriented in their music, with a little bit of country overtones too. So the Prisoners existed beyond the era that I'm describing, which is essentially, you know, from the spring of 1953 till the summer of 1954. The Prisoners existed beyond that, but in different iterations, none of which were recorded anything as indelible as Just Walking in the Rain.
And we'll be right back to wrap things up on MTSU on the Record.
The MTSU Department of Art has the newest facility for visual arts in the state, with approximately 50,000 square feet of space, including high-tech computers and computer-driven equipment for multimedia, graphic design, printmaking, sculpture, painting, and ceramics. We feature a visiting artist lecture program and an exhibition program that exposes students to work by national and international artists. This is Jean Nagy, Chair of the Department of Art.
To find out more, visit mtsunews.com.
In our final moments with John Dugan, this is rather like the story of Robert Stroud, the birdman of Alcatraz, who became an expert, world-renowned, academically credible expert on bird diseases while in prison. This is a convicted killer. Or Wilbert Rideau in Louisiana, who was a convicted killer who published an award-winning newspaper in the prison while he was incarcerated at Angola State Penitentiary. Right. It's the sort of thing that makes you wonder, what could have been accomplished? What could these men have done with their lives if somebody had gotten to them before they committed the first crime? What kind of careers they could have had?
I mean, that's a, kind of a central irony to the story is that, you know, everything about the song and about their very brief career in this early iteration is linked to what I call their convictness. That this story becomes, I mean, it's an interesting story in and of itself, but it becomes slightly more interesting, slightly more ironic that they're given this sense of limited freedom by going out and performing, but it never turns into complete and total freedom.
Right. So they're not rewarded for doing the right thing, and they're not rewarded for doing the wrong thing. Right. Everything they do is wrong.
Right. And what's remarkable about it, too, is that in all the times they had an opportunity to escape, they never did. They never did.
They never even tried.
There's not one instance of them, and there were numerous opportunities where it would have been very easy for one of them to just simply walk away. And they didn't do it. Now, you know, there were other instances where they were in leg irons or they were, you know, it would have been impossible for them to run away. But you have to remember that Frank Clement was bringing them up to the governor's mansion on almost a weekly basis. And his wife was, James Edwards' wife, Red, was driving them there.
So they felt that somebody believed in them.
Right, right.
Just on the basis of sheer vocal talent, knowing full well that anything could be abridged or twisted by the economics of the time, the race issue, the fluctuations in the recording industry, but just on the basis of the way their voices sounded together, did they have the raw potential to have really gone somewhere as a group and been megastars if they had not been prisoners first?
I think so. I mean, when you listen to them in relation to other early doo-wop vocal groups of the time, they're certainly better than most. They might not have been in that upper echelon of vocal groups, like I think of Sonny Till and the Orioles, who were a remarkable vocal group. There are times where Johnny kind of emulates Sonny Till's vocal style, but he's not quite the singer that Sonny Till was. But that said, they were a very strong vocal ensemble. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that if you matched their talents with the right material, the sky would have been the limit. And I think they were able to do that once with Just Walking in the Rain. The sad reality is that there are other songs they recorded that are good, but nothing quite like Just Walking in the Rain.
It wasn't necessarily the best material at the best time.
Right, right.
John Dugan is a professor of recording industry at MTSU and author of The Mistakes of Yesterday, The Hopes of Tomorrow, The Story of the Prison Heirs from University of Massachusetts Press. Available, I take it, on Amazon.com and at Barnes & Noble.
At bookstores real and virtual near you now.
Thanks for being with us, John.
Thank you.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.